From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Kenya with the recent randomized trial designed to help people living in the area, many in poverty. And instead of creating a housing program there or a food program or a work program, the trial in Kenya cut away the middleman. Instead, Kenyans in the trial received cash. Basic stack of money, essentially. No strings, no requirements on what to do with it. Now, one of the arguments against this kind of thing is that poor people will just buy drugs or alcohol or blow it at the casino. In this case, though, people who received direct cash assistance were found to buy more goods, more food, built more assets. Later, they were measured as being more all-around happy than those who got help through other programs. And I know what you're saying, that's one case, one place. But the World Bank's David Evans and Anna Popova recently published a paper reviewing 19 such studies. They wanted to know if direct cash transfers, basically just giving people money, is more effective and efficient. And their conclusion is, essentially, it is. It's a lot more efficient than most programs we've been talking about. And so here we are in Rochester with the new anti-poverty initiative in full swing. Is anyone in Rochester calling for simply giving poor people money, tax dollars, charity, or otherwise? The answer is maybe yes. And we're about to have that discussion. And listen, I know if some of our listening audience is going, you're seriously talking about just giving people money, and if it feels like some kind of a caricature, but this is a real discussion. This has been studied, and we're going to try to have an honest discussion this hour. If you want to call the program with your questions about it, you can do that. Let me welcome those who gave me the idea to think about this. Erica Rosenberg's a principal with the Center for Governmental Research. New to us, but this is not a new idea to you, is it?
Well, it's something that we learned a little bit about more than a year ago when we started doing some work for the United Way as the whole anti-poverty initiative in our town was just starting to gather some steam. And it was, as you kind of described, the more we looked into it, the more we were surprised and intrigued by the positive research findings.
I have to admit, I mean, I've tried to find through various means anything out there that is really negative about the idea of just giving poor people money, and I haven't found anything.
No, we haven't either. And, you know, I'm sure we could spend more time looking and we might come up with something. And there's certainly negative commentary out there. And as you say, negative biases against this, which are to some extent understandable. If you think about American culture and where we come from and what we tend to believe, you know, it's a lot of the pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality, the work ethic mentality. And so this idea really does go directly against that. And I think it's hard for people to, some people anyway, to kind of open their minds to it.
All right, so we're going to be talking with Eric about that. Also here from the Center for Governmental Research is Senior Associate Pete Nabosny. Peter, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Carolyn Lee Davis is here, a Senior Policy Analyst for the Children's Agenda in Rochester. And Carolyn, nice to have you as well.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
All right, so Erica says, Carolyn, it was about a year ago that it came on the radar for CGR. When did it come on your radar?
Yeah, so actually at the Children's Agenda, a couple of us stumbled across an article in the New York Times about a year and a half ago where they were highlighting some research that was coming out of North Carolina and a study that was done there at a Cherokee reservation where as a casino was put in place, what the decision was made that based on the profits, everybody that was a part of the reservation would get a basic grant based on the level of profits that would come in. As luck would have it, there was a North Carolina professor, UNC Chapel Hill professor, who was already working with the reservation. And so a natural experiment to some degree was able to take effect because she already had some baseline information on these children and families. And what they found was simply this annual grant based on casino profits elevated family outcomes and child outcomes and really improved the family well-being based on this. And so that's what really got the Children's Agenda thinking about it and looking into it more deeply.
Okay. Pete, when you first heard about it, did you, you know, on a policy side of things, what are the questions that came to mind for you?
Sure. So I think like everyone else who kind of first looked into this topic, you do wonder about sort of, you know, what are the downsides to it? I mean, that's what we've kind of been talking about already. Your mind immediately switches to, well, there has to be a negative, right? And so there are ideas out there, like you said, that people are going to spend it on things that we don't want them spending it on. Or, you know, there's also a concern that people will stop working. And we, you know, prioritize work in our culture. And, I wanted to see, does that happen? And certainly with the study in North Carolina, it wasn't founded. There's actually a really interesting story in Canada in the 70s that I became a little bit obsessed with as we were kind of doing the research, where they guaranteed the minimum income of a town in Manitoba for 5 years in the 70s before kind of budget concerns caused them to discontinue the program. And all this data just kind of sat there for 20-some-odd years. And researchers eventually went back and looked at health records and administrative data, and they found all sorts of really interesting improvements in well-being, mental health well-being. And they didn't find a really significant decline in people working, which I think was a big concern that a lot of people had.
Yeah, when it comes to some of the, I'm going to say stereotypes or assumptions people will make when we talk about, should we just give poor people money? Should we kind of just make it simpler that way? No strings, especially, because some of these studies, again, do have cash with strings and cash not with strings. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in sort of the no strings stuff. But Erica, you say you encounter what kind of stereotypes immediately when you talk about this in our community in Rochester. What do people generally say?
And I haven't talked about it a lot, but I think that one of the things you do run across immediately is sort of a worry that there will be a worst case scenario. And there was one leader that I mentioned this idea to, you know, and the first thing this person said was, well, if one person uses it to buy heroin, for example, you know, it's kind of sunk the whole program. So I think, you know, even among people who may not hold stereotypes about the poor, there's just kind of a fear. You know, certainly you can understand from a political leader's standpoint that it doesn't even need to be 50% of the people who, you know, blow the money on drugs and, you know, whatever else. It only needs to be a few cases that get a lot of coverage, and that can really have a damaging effect on the overall program. I just think, as you've said, you know, the more we look at this research, and this particular question has been studied now many times recently, mostly on the international level, of whether, you know, consumption of alcohol and tobacco has increased. Again, this wasn't looked at, I don't think, quite as much maybe in North Carolina as it has been recently in places like Africa and Mexico. But they're really finding no evidence to suggest that that happens. And what I think is really interesting about that is that it holds with the findings from North Carolina that people's mental health, their parenting skills improve. And that really one of the fundamental things that cash does, and I think we can all kind of relate to this, is it takes away stress that people face when they are living hand to mouth. And, you know, people who are drug addicts and alcoholics and addicted to smoking, cash isn't going to necessarily get them off of those substances. But people who are using those substances to cope with the daily stresses of being poor very well may find they don't need them as much with a little more cash in their pockets.
Jim on Twitter refers directly to that. He said there was that experiment along the lines in North Carolina. The impact was larger than the cash amount. And otherwise, sometimes we talk about a multiplier effect. It looks
Absolutely.
Like that's the kind of thing that we're talking about there. Already getting a lot of feedback online. Eileen says, I'm hesitantly in favor of this. Programs don't fix broken cars or buy gas or buy diapers. Decent medical care and livable wages are necessary too. And where was the comment this morning I saw? Here's Ben says, how about just establishing a minimum income and making sure everyone gets at least that? Then you can end all of the programs. I don't know if you can end all the programs, but Ben is saying, set that minimum income. And again, what Pete became interested in was, you said it was Manitoba?
Yeah.
Canada, 1970s.
Correct.
No evidence over 5 years that people who knew they had a minimum income were going to stop working.
Yeah, there was a few small groups in that town, subsets of people that worked a bit less. And the two groups were teenagers who often were staying in high school. That was one of the outcomes of that.
Otherwise, they were dropping out?
They were dropping out of high school to help support their families,
okay.
Which I think we would broadly agree as a society that's a good thing, that
sure.
They stay in high school.
Yeah.
And some new mothers chose to stay home, and they were typically the secondary breadwinner for the family. So there was some small effect on mothers' working hours that, again, I think different people may have different opinions on this, but it's certainly an understandable decision if a mother decides to stay home to care for her new child for a little bit longer prior to kind of reentering the workforce.
Carolyn Lee Davis, do you have any opposition to mom staying home instead of working? I doubt the children's agenda is going to be opposed to that.
No, there's lots of good benefits. Yeah.
When it comes, though, Pete, to that one place in that one sort of window of time, historically, then what happened? I mean, did that minimum income go away? You know, did it happen sort of in a vacuum?
Sure. So, well, Canada, like the U.S. in the late 70s, was dealing with some issues of inflation and kind of a general economic malaise. And so it was a consequence of budget cuts. And when they introduced the program, I don't think they'd really thought through the sort of the evaluation that we'd love to see for it. And so, but they had been collecting some data, and it literally sat in a warehouse in Manitoba for 20 some odd years before people started saying, "Hey, we should look back and what happened to these families." And speaking to Erica's point a moment ago, one of the things that they found that there was a really a positive, decrease in hospital admissions, particularly for mental health conditions, which are quite expensive. And there was, some evidence to suggest that, parts of this program, saved Canada money through reduced usage of particularly emergency services, but a whole host of other mental health visits and programs that, can be quite expensive to taxpayers.
We're talking about various studies and the broader issue of should we simply give poor people cash, no strings cash, instead of, well, I don't know if it's instead of, Erica Rosenberg from CGR, there's no, as far as I know, there's not a single proposal that is, has every detail in place about how it would happen in Rochester, for example.
No.
But from what you're seeing in other communities, other studies, is there a more efficient and effective way to do this, tax dollars or charity, or what's sort of the model that you think might roll out effectively here?
What would be the mechanism? I don't know that we've done a lot of detailed thinking about that. Certainly an enhanced kind of earned income tax credit would be one way to help working poor people. We have that in place now, and I think the state even has an enhanced version of it. But as part of the study I was mentioning, where we kind of started getting interested in this idea that we did for the United Way, we also looked at the experience in Great Britain, which is the most recent real success story of significantly decreasing child poverty, which is obviously one of the things we're most concerned about here in Rochester. And the a bigger earned income tax credit for working families, along with more child care subsidies and more support for parents and in low income families, that was all part of what made Great Britain's experiment so successful and so long lasting, even through the terrible international recession of 2008. However, I think what we want to start to think about is how to help the poor people who aren't working. Helping poor people who are working is something that is very politically palatable, pretty popular, certainly among some circles. But the idea of actually just giving cash to people who aren't working is what's been tested in various ways, sometimes accidentally, and all these other places. And I think, that's really what we at CGR, almost just from a pointy-headed researcher's perspective, think would be really interesting to test in our community, because it's not going to have exactly the same impacts as the studies we're talking about in Africa, right? I mean, when people are given big, what's to them really big cash grants in Africa, they do things like invest in livestock and farming equipment and things like that. Those aren't going to be the kinds of investments that poor people in inner city of Rochester make, but we're just very interested in potentially, seeing that studied and really tried here.
If you want to call the program and weigh in on the subject, we'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Now, all three of my guests this hour are interested in the research, and if the research were to come out and say, well, fewer people work, a lot of people stop working, and it's not just teenagers and it's not just new moms, or people use it to buy whatever we decide is unseemly that we don't want them buying, they're going to say so, and the studies are going to say so. All we're doing is looking at the known data and the known research, but part of what Erica is saying is we need more of it. We need to see more of how it might work. Let me ask a couple of questions on this subject, and I'll ask the entire panel this. Erica, you mentioned that someone said to you, one person goes out and buys heroin, that sinks the program.
Right.
If one person went out and bought heroin in a cash program, would it sink the program?
Well, I think that's a hard question to answer, depending on how much attention.
Or should it sink the program?
Should it sink the program?
Because somebody probably will.
Right.
If you're going to give cash to, 10,000 people in poverty, 5,000 people, one person at least is probably going to.
Exactly.
Does that sink the program?
I would not think that it should, as you just pointed out, because, if you believe that low-income people are like the rest of everybody else, there's going to be some bad apples who are going to make some bad decisions with it, right? So, the fear is that it would get blown out of proportion, that it would become a media sensation, and that, it would have that kind of effect.
So Carolyn?
I would just weigh in and say, you know, what should sink any program is when we look at the evaluations and the research and we see that it doesn't improve outcomes for children and families in the community.
That is so high-minded of you.
And so, you know, I think what would be really interesting about a Rochester experiment is to put to the test these proven experiments from other places and to see what our own outcomes would be and to really delve in and see if we would see the same kind of outcomes. But when you look at, and I'm going to mention EITC a little bit, it is different in that, you know, the real beneficiaries of EITC are working families, and it is very much built to reward and motivate working. But what's similar is that you essentially get an additional cash grant once a year as a result of participating in EITC. And what they've really found through researching that is that family well-being improves in multiple ways. So physical health, mental health, better school performance, better college performance. Families are paying, adults are paying into Social Security more, so their retirement years look better. So there's just really additional, in many ways, good decisions that are made by families who are cash-strapped when they get more cash. What we really see over and over again from these studies is they make good decisions that help their families.
Okay. Pete, concern about the heroin? And I take exactly what Carolyn and Eric are saying. The media would probably blow one story like that out of proportion. There would be a risk of that.
Maybe not.
Well, I think it's a fair concern.
So speaking for myself, I have to assume that would happen, right? That some number of people, if you give any kind of program to enough people, people with substance abuse issues don't stop having substance abuse issues just because they have a little more money in their pocket. And, I think that we have to, if we look at these things on the whole, if broadly speaking, societal well-being is improved and children are doing better in school and parents are developing better parenting skills because they have a little more freedom to spend time with their kids. And some small number of people do make bad decisions with the money. I think, you know, as a society, we have to grapple with those things. And we have to figure out what we're comfortable doing. And, I just also would like to say that, you know, there are, you know, food stamp programs today that people trade in. You know, there's studies that show that people trade in 20 cents on the dollar of food stamps because they have an addiction. And, you know, that's something we would want, we don't want. And, but we've, as a society, broadly accepted the fact that, you know, poor people should have food. Everyone should have food. Their children should have food. And we're going to assume some amount of risk with public dollars to ensure that, broadly speaking, the people in our society and our communities are well fed and have access to sustenance.
Let me get to the phones here, and Matt in Shortsville is first up to weigh in. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I would just like to make a comment that we have a local clinic that charges $40 whether you have insurance or you don't have insurance for any kind of health care. And even today, I just paid my eye doctor bill in Palmyra, and if I used my insurance, it was almost $200. If I didn't have insurance, it was $80. So I think the disparity of having to have a health care program is actually not beneficial to society. My own daughter, who was working full-time at SUNY Cortland as a student, her hours were cut back because of the health care law from 40 hours to 30 hours. Now she's working two part-time jobs, both of them below $10 an hour.
Matt, thanks for the phone call. And sort of, I guess, kind of related here. I mean, but Pete, you want to weigh in? Go ahead.
Sure. I think the second part of his comment there was kind of particularly interesting because I think that's one of the criticisms a lot of people have with our existing social safety net, that there are certain incentives built in when you create a healthcare benefit that cuts off at a certain level,
sure,
or a childcare subsidy that cuts off at a certain level, or housing vouchers, or all these different programs, including food stamps, that it causes people rightly to start evaluating these things. And you know, there's some talk in the community about a poverty trap or poverty treadmill, where it doesn't make sense for you to make that additional dollar,
right,
because then you would lose some number of benefits. And I think the genius of a cash program, as far as, you know, I can tell, is that obviously, you know, you do need to build in some, you know, scale out like they do with the EITC. As you know, people make more money, it's rewarded, and eventually that line is cut off. But With cash programs, you're able to kind of be much more adaptive and have, you know, avoid these cliffs and all sorts of other sort of really difficult policy decisions because of the nature of eligibility for existing programs.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, on the point of sort of the unintended consequences, what he's talking about there in relation to the healthcare law, I've heard that from a number of places, and I think as laws as you go forward, you try to weed out the unintended consequences. Yeah. In this community, we've talked about child care funding in various places. And one of the most interesting moments in the recent county executive race came just a few days before the election when the eventual winner, Cheryl Donolfo, was on this program. And we were looking for specific ways that she would handle child care that might be different from either her opponents or the current county executive, Maggie Brooks, because Maggie Brooks has said, you know, the state cut some child care funding. There's only so much we can do, et cetera. And what Cheryl Donolfo said that was different was we are going to set a floor. We're going to set a baseline for this community that says no matter what happens at the state level, we need X amount at least for child care funding. And if we get more, we get more, but we are going to fund this. And she didn't specifically say what that floor is, mm-hmm. but that was new. And our colleague Veronica Volk asked Maggie Brooks just last week, you know, Cheryl Donolfo said it's time to set a floor. And will you do that in your final budget as she moves into her first year in office? And Ms. Brooks rather pointedly said, you know, this is not Cheryl Donolfo's budget. So no, the answer was no. But along with that, with the floor, was the question on how do you make sure that there isn't that donut or that level where you're disincentivized to either work or make more money. And she said, we want to have a sliding scale. So they want a floor and a sliding scale that helps adjust for that so you don't get all of a sudden get that moment where you think, if I work more hours or I take this job, it actually, it sort of is a, it's a non-benefit. So anyway, these kind of conversations I think are helpful to have because I don't think anybody has all the answers.
Right.
It will be interesting to see if Ms. Donolfo follows through with that. Let's get back to the phones. And Henry is calling from Boston. All right. Henry in Boston. Go ahead, Henry.
Hi. I wanted to ask the panelists, it seems like they're talking about sort of a trend where employment is a little bit less connected to some of the necessities of life, both healthcare recently with the ACA, more and more people aren't getting healthcare through their work. And a basic income, too, would sort of free people up to take on not necessarily jobs, but a variety of job-like things, driving for Uber or something like that. And so it seems like there's a real change in sort of what employment is that's happening that's motivating things like basic income and the ACA. And so I wanted to ask if they had thoughts about any other impacts of that change in sort of what we think of as employment.
Thank you, Henry. Listening online in Boston, I assume.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I appreciate that. Stay on the line with us, and we'll go around the table. Erica Rosenberg from Center for Governmental Research.
I haven't given a lot of thought to that question, although it's a very interesting issue that Henry brings up. And, of course, we are seeing a lot of changes and evolutions in, you know, how people work and the kind of hours that they make. I know that one of the this is sort of unrelated, but, you know, one of the impacts that's been found in some of these studies of the cash grant programs is that people stay in school longer. So, you know, finding the other kind of creative ways to work, different kinds of jobs is one potential outcome. And then people getting more education and being, again, you know, sort of, if we're thinking about how to lift people out of poverty, you know, certainly allowing them to spend time in, you know, at a minimum high school, but then post-secondary education certainly positions them better for long-term success.
Yeah, I guess when I think in particular about families and workers who are making kind of new decisions around their working style right now. Well, a lot of it is because, and this may be for the issues I work around and the families I work with, but a lot of it's around the low pay they're getting in one job and what they're having to put together of a couple jobs to make ends meet. And in addition, if it's a part-time job, where the hours are kept to and what where their wage may be less than a living wage. So I guess the connection for me with something like this is thinking about regardless of what situations you might be pushed into or motivated to take for a variety of reasons, that this would at least ensure for you and your family a minimum income to cover those costs.
Yeah, I think to Henry's point there, I think one of the interesting things about the Affordable Care Act and ideas like programs like this is that, and this is why I think we need more research in it and we need more, you know, more pilot programs that we can evaluate, is what impact does it have, do these things have on entrepreneurialism? You know, if somebody knows that they're going to have you know, some guarantee of income there, or some regular cash, you know, payment that they receive. You know, do they take a risk at opening a small business? Do they try something that they haven't done before?
You know, and here's the thing, Pete. That's such an interesting way to look at it, because this morning one of the dissenters online was saying this is going to kill innovation. That what this does is it says you don't have to work, you'll get money, you don't have to be creative. It doesn't reward innovation and hard work. What you're saying is if people know there's a baseline of income, they might be more encouraged to try things that would ostensibly or otherwise be risky.
Perhaps, and you know, I think that what I'd like to see is kind of more research around that, and to see, you know, the United States has a, you know, we pride ourselves in having an entrepreneurial culture, and while these programs exist large scale in a lot of the developing world, and I think we've seen some of those elements in the developing world, I'd like to see what would happen around here if people did have that space or that opportunity.
Henry, any follow up before we hang up on you in Boston? Are you there, Henry? Oh, well, we appreciate the phone call, and we appreciate him listening online. You can always listen online at wxxi.org/listen or on the WXXI mobile app. We'll get to more of your phone calls in a minute. Let's get a short break in, and when we come back, Miles writes to us, says, ultimately, this is a waste of time. No American government is ever going to consider just giving poor people a pile of cash. And would it be my tax dollars, and how much? He wants to know. Okay, so Miles, we're going to answer that, as best we can, at least, after this short break as we continue the discussion on this idea on helping people in poverty. Is it time to simply think about looking at studies in other places and trying it in Rochester, giving poor people cash? Erica Rosenberg is a principal with the Center for Governmental Research. Peter Nabosny is a senior associate with CGR. And Carolyn Lee Davis is a senior policy analyst with the Children's Agenda. Much more next. Coming up in our second hour, ethical hunting. How do we define hunting animals ethically? How do we make sure they don't suffer? A guest column in the Democrat and Chronicle recently argued that there's no such thing as ethical hunting, that we shouldn't inflict any pain on animals, even if we intend to eat them. But the hunting community says that's getting it wrong. We'll have that discussion next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2016 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Your phone lines are lit up, and we're going to be going through your calls and questions and comments for the rest of the hour as we talk about this. It's not meant to just be a sort of this will never happen idea. The Center for Governmental Research is a very serious organization that has done a lot of work in this community and elsewhere. And Erica Rosenberg wouldn't have said to me recently, I've been talking about this, that we should look at this. And you had it in, where was it, the December report?
Yes.
What was the report?
It was for the United Way, and it was, again, as the whole anti-poverty initiative was really just in its infancy, they wanted sort of an international scan of effective approaches to dealing with poverty.
So it didn't say this is the only thing to do, but
no.
It said what's happening, what is happening around the world, mm-hmm. and what seems to be working, and what should we think about?
Right.
And this, direct cash assistance, giving poor people money directly, it was on the list. So
right.
Miles writes to us and says, never going to happen. This is a waste of time. American governments are not, taxpayers won't do it. And by the way, how much of my own tax dollars are we going to use for this?
Right.
I'll start with Erica.
So a couple quick things. Very astute, obviously. I mean, there's a tremendous cultural, political hurdle that I think we need to get over. On the other hand, it has been tried. There were some experiments in the late 60s and the early 70s in a few cities, and I don't know exactly which ones, around negative income tax, which was basically the same idea. That was studied. It was found to have a lot of the positive benefits that we're talking about. It did have an effect that some people felt was negative, and Pete's already discussed it. There was a small decline, as I understand it, in working hours among all the households, and it seemed to be concentrated in women who took a little bit longer to go back into the workforce after they had babies. It has been tried. It was sort of discredited, is my understanding, after that time period. But I do think there's a big hurdle to get over, which is in part why, in our report, we recommended experimenting with it, evaluating it, basically approaching it as a pilot program. And I think one of the things that I would encourage people to think about as they, you know, try to maybe open their minds to this concept is, you know, weighing it against the other options that we have for dealing with poverty. So, you know, we have a lot of social supports and systems right now that do provide some basic support to people who are in poverty. And I think the research on those programs, not all of it, but the experience we've seen with the overall poverty rate, and certainly here locally, is that it's not lifting a lot of people out of poverty. It's helping people. Those programs are helping people. They're providing things that people need. They're abused to some extent from time to time, right? But they're not lifting people out of poverty. So, we certainly wouldn't recommend anything as radical as shifting all the money that's going into those programs now into cash grants for poor people. But a small experiment that really rigorously kind of evaluates this, you know, we think is reasonable. Another thing I just wanted to bring up quickly was the minimum wage debate, because obviously that's very timely. I know you did a whole show on it recently. And many people who are concerned about poverty are in favor of an increase in the minimum wage, which is very understandable. But if you look at the research on the effects of the minimum wage, there are winners and losers among the low-income population. So while some people who are in poverty will make higher wages and improve their standing in life, other people will lose their jobs completely. So as an anti-poverty strategy, I mean, the minimum wage has a lot of problems with it. So again, I recommend kind of evaluating the cash grants, which seems very radical in the context of everything else, and kind of weighing the pros and cons.
Okay, and before we get back to the phones, and we're coming there in just a second, if you're waiting, I promise we're going to get to you. But one more quick question then. When we look at the way this might happen, you know, do you target it to a part of the city? Do you, do you do it sort of geographically? Do you do it, what kind of a population? What's the model that we think might set up, that might work here? Carolyn?
So I would be inclined to think that you would want to, based on the research that's been done and looking at this, certainly some of what was really found, for example, from that North Carolina study that we're referencing earlier, that it was families who had the youngest children that saw the biggest impact and most improved outcomes, which certainly is aligned with other research we've talked about in the past, where we see a lot of benefit when you intervene early in a family's life. So I would be inclined to think about a pilot that would really focus and think about families in our community with young children as one first group to prioritize, to really look and work at this to see if it would improve their well-being and lifting them out of poverty. I think especially when we look at those poverty numbers that Erica was just referencing a little bit, we know that 53% of our children under 5 here in Rochester are living in poverty. That's a really astounding figure. Yeah. And we know, I believe it's about 25% of children up to age 18 are living in extreme poverty. Extreme poverty, again, is half the poverty rate. So if you're talking about a family of 4, you're talking about them trying to live on like $13,000 a year, which is a little hard to even start to think about. So I think that we know there's great need around that piece of our community. We know that the research indicates we might see the best outcome. And to Miles' earlier question around, is this my taxpayer dollars? And I can certainly imagine some of my family members, you know, around the Thanksgiving table raising their eyebrows at me too, thinking about this. You know, I think to Erica's point, you want to weigh the different ways we're using taxpayer dollars. And if this indicates savings for taxpayers, especially down the road when you look at all the improvements for children and families as a result, we might rather spend our dollars this way.
Okay, so an outlay, though, per family, per person, of how much? To try to answer Miles' question. Do we know? Do we have an idea?
I mean, I would think it would need to be substantial, so you're not talking about a few $100 a year. I would
think $5,000 to $10,000?
Yes. I would think you'd want to see it at that level. Uh-huh. In that range, yeah. Based on the North Carolina, kind of study, you know, that's sort of what would be a starting point for getting that kind of impact, I would think.
Pete?
Yeah. And I agree with Erica. I think, best structured, you want a cash supplement to someone's other income, you know, so that there is still, you know, we do want to encourage people to work. If we gave everyone, first of all, we couldn't afford it, but if we gave everyone $70,000 a year, then people are going to stop working at some level. But some amount of assistance that's enough to be meaningful to that family to provide some security, but while also, you know, continuing to encourage work. And I think, to the tax issue, I think that this is an opportunity where, you know, the private sector or the philanthropic sector, could step forward and help pilot something so that, you know, I think there are concerns out
right
there, and I understand those concerns. And so let's say you raise some private money to support I don't know, 100 families for some number of years, and then evaluate how are those kids doing in school? Are they going to school? How are their grades? I think are those families using less, you know, medical care? Are there other savings that we can find as a society? And then, you know, we'd have to look at that against other programs and see, is this more effective? And if it is, then, you know, there may be some more political willingness to spend, you know, scarce taxpayer dollars on these kinds of programs.
So for any listeners who think this is just a lefty idea, that endless minimum wage, endless assistance, the panel is agreeing that, number one, there are diminishing returns on where you'd set that basic income if we did it that way. And you just heard Pete say, if everybody is guaranteed a $70,000, whatever, annual wage, then yeah, you're going to see fewer people work. What we've seen in a very small amount of trials so far with a basic wage or a sort of an expected annual income is that it has spurred, it might spur actual creative ideas. And the only people who are cutting back on hours were children, were teenagers and new moms, because it wasn't a $50,000 or $70,000 or $100,000 annual income. And we need more study on this. So that's kind of where we are with this.
Sure. Yeah. And I'd also like just to point out that there's a conservative case for this kind of program as well. Milton Friedman was a big proponent of a guaranteed basic income, and thought it was a great alternative to the kind of the web of social safety net programs that we have, because he felt that it was a more efficient way to help the poor. And there's an argument that, cash support for people living in poverty to get them out of poverty is, first of all, more efficient from a expenditure level. There's less sort of overhead and bureaucracy and all those other things that people are sometimes, you know, very concerned with. And it's less reliant on sort of this notion of central planning that government administrators, elected officials know what's best for everyone in society, that they can properly balance how much housing subsidy someone needs and childcare subsidy and food stamps and all sorts of other, assistance. Whereas if you trust in people to work these things out themselves, you need less sort of government oversight and centralized planning, which a lot of people are, concerned with.
This has become an anti-central planning, which is a very savvy way to have this kind of a conversation. This is Assemblyman Mark Johns calling the program. Assemblyman, thanks for calling. What would you like to say about what you're hearing today?
A lot of good ideas, that's what I'd like to say. Back in the, I think it was the 70s, there was a senator from this state, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, which you're all too young to remember.
But, I don't think so, but go ahead.
That sounds pretty good, right? Daniel Patrick Moynihan had that idea, kind of like Milton Friedman. It was called a reverse income tax. And now you have Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and others talking about good-paying jobs leaving the country and, income disparity. A reverse income tax would basically, instead of raising the minimum wage to 15, let's say the minimum wage is $9 an hour, you fill in the gap. So you're having people go out there, reverse income tax, work fair, whatever you want to call it. Everybody that's out there working fills out an IRS form every year, and if you're low income, you're going to make up the difference. So basically $6 an hour, which is $12,000 a year. And they'll get monthly checks, $1,000 a month for the future year. And then when they do their taxes, if their income has gone up, maybe they won't get $1,000 a month, but they won't be cut dollar for dollar. Maybe they'll be cut $1 for every $2 they earn. And you're going to get rid of all the bureaucracy, which takes up about one-third of the money. When you have to have buildings and programs and people working the system and the bureaucracy that you've mentioned and the retirements and the pensions and the health care for all the people that are working, about two-thirds or about one-third of that money that could be going to people that are low income is going to the bureaucracy.
So this is a Republican assemblyman making the point that this would be more efficient, similar to the discussions we've had in past years about the rebate checks. The government takes your money and then they create a program to send you some of your money back instead of finding other ways to do it or earned income.
Well, let me be clear. I'm not for those rebate checks, but I know that if you, the EITC, your earned income tax credit, they get a lump sum in April or May, and you could blow that money on God knows what. But I'm talking about a monthly income check. Mm-hmm. The same way you get a Social Security check or a pension check, based on your income. And we're not going to be helping people that don't work. I'm talking about people that do work. The income disparity, for a lot of different reasons, mostly because of we have worldwide competition. We're going to raise our minimum wage to $15 an hour. Jobs are going to go to other states. And by the way, when they don't go to other states, they go to other countries. It's a race to the bottom.
But Mark, one quick question before I let our panel respond here. Would you be in favor of this kind of assistance for people who do not work or are not currently working?
Well, we bring in 15, 20, 30 million immigrants, legal and illegal, to do jobs that Americans could be doing. And they happen to be low-income jobs, but you know what? They have to be done. Working on farms, working in food processing. Let's start, and I know we have to be competitive, so let's not punish the job creators or the people that own businesses, but let's take our money that we spend hundreds of billions of dollars on social service programs, and let's give it to people who work. Let's have workfare. Why would we punish people who want to get out and work, who want to get off welfare, and then we punish them? If they had that money, they could use it for daycare and childcare, and they know what to buy at Wegmans and Tops.
All right. Well, a sentiment. Thank you, Erica Rosenberg. I'm going to start with you. You know, I don't know how much you've had a chance to talk directly to elected leaders like Mark Johns in the past year about this, but what do you think of what you just heard from the Assemblyman?
Oh, I thought it was very interesting and not necessarily surprising. I mean, as Pete alluded to, you know, there is sort of a Republican/conservative case to be made for exploring this type of idea a little bit further. One of the things I wanted to just explore a little bit, you know, the question about, is it a basic income that's ongoing or is it a one-time grant? You know, we're kind of convoluting the two in what we're discussing. We're talking about both types of programs. So there would be a choice that would need to be made about that. I also think it's interesting, you know, the question about whether you tie it to working or not, right? It's always going to be a more politically popular thing to do to say we're going to give this additional assistance to people who work. But there was a really interesting article recently in the Boston Globe that looked at some data on the U.S. in comparison with European countries and looking at the poverty rates in all those countries before taxes and transfers. And our poverty rate, for this particular year, is about 28% before anybody pays taxes and before any of the transfer payments happen. And that's in line with, you know, Spain, France, Germany, Sweden, Denmark. It's about the same. But when you account for taxes and transfers, our poverty rate is 18%, higher than anybody else. So all these other countries that I just mentioned, Spain, Canada, Sweden, Germany, France, Denmark, they're just doing more with taxes and transfers to get income to people who are poor. And what I think is interesting is one of the conclusions this author reaches is that none of these countries has been able to tackle poverty by building an economy that works for everybody. So the idea that we really hold dear in the U.S., that we can get to the point where pretty much everybody is working except for a small part of the population that may be disabled, et cetera.
Full employment, I guess.
Yeah. Doesn't seem to exist in reality, though we might wish it were it did.
Other panelists, you heard from the Assemblyman. Does that encourage you that at least lawmakers are going to be open to having these kind of conversations? Pete Nabosny?
Sure. I mean, I think it's always encouraging to hear that people are interested in this idea. And I think that there's, of everything he said, one thing that really struck me is the idea of kind of graduating those payments out over the course of a year. That's one of the things that they've done in Great Britain. The EITC here, you get it around tax time, you get that check, and it's a boon for that family for some stretch of time. But it would be hard for any of us to manage our finances in a way that we spread that out over the course of a year efficiently and planning properly for, you know, unexpected future expenses. And so one of the things that they've done in Great Britain is distribute that their equivalent of their income tax credit and their other child credits, you know, proportionally over the course of a year. And that's given families a lot of stability in their income. Again, if somebody, you know, been doing well in March or April, and they get their check and they decide to, invest in something, a new car, and then 3 months later they lose their job. Well, they don't have that money anymore that otherwise could have helped them get through that tough period. So some way to kind of to level that income off over the course of a year can be really helpful for families' budgeting purposes and managing their household finances differently.
All right, let me get back to the phones, and Sam in Pittsford wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, Evan, it's been a while.
Tim, how you doing, Tim?
I'm all for this, and I am, just to let everyone there know, I am a liberal, but I'm a realist. I'm all for this idea, but is it going to consolidate the other taxes that I pay, or is it just added on to everything? Because I'll be honest, last week in my paycheck, which is organized very nicely for me, I had almost $400 taken out in taxes alone. That's not including all the other pretty stuff that gets taken out of there. My mortgage every month, my property and school tax is more than I pay in my mortgage. That's almost $1,000 a month. So let's say 400, that's 1,600 plus, let's say around 1,000 a month. $2,600 a month is leaving me to go to taxes. If this idea is going to work, and I hope it does, can you honestly say to me that less money will be coming out of my paycheck, or is this just going to be built on top of that? Because this is, Evan knows this because I've been calling and I email about this. Taxes are killing the people in what were supposed to be the middle or the upper middle, which weren't not even anymore, but just $2,600 a month leaving. And I'm hoping it can go down a little bit if this could ever happen.
Well, Tim, thanks for the phone call. And I think there's a lot of people wondering what Tim is. So there might be an initial outlay, but could this actually save money? Is that part of the conservative case? Carolyn?
Yeah, so I would say that the question's a little bit down the road, because I really agree with Pete and Erica that we want to do a really good experiment here and evaluate a pilot and see, and then that would indicate what kind of tax savings we would see. But the hope would be, and I know taxes are such a big concern to so many of our fellow residents here, and the hope would be that, no, in the long term, it wouldn't be an increased tax, that it would offset other things that we're already paying for our taxes. And as we would see those costs go down, this would be fundable through those dollars. And I think in general, we want to think about our government dollars, which are always scarce and feel like they're always getting more scarce, about using them in the most efficient and best ways possible and funding the things we know that work and not funding things we don't work. So it would be more about transferring from other categories.
Sure. And what Pete was saying about Milt Friedman, that's part of the argument, right, Pete? I mean, more efficient. We're going to help people anyway. Let's do it efficiently. Let's do it directly. And let's do it in a way that can actually cut the overall cost. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's the idea. I think, there are a couple different ways you could look at this. I agree. I think for anything to be sort of politically palatable, people would need to, you know, see some savings at some point, whether it's diverting funds from existing programs or hopefully, you know, seeing savings down the road. So again, I just like to kind of point out that a lot of these pilot programs that have existed elsewhere or studies that have shown that they do show, you know, reductions in government spending down the road, particularly in areas of healthcare. There's also, you know, I think one could surmise if more people are graduating from high school, if more people are going to college because of programs like this, then they're going to be, you know, part of the tax-paying workforce later in life. And the goal of these things is to help people leave poverty. And so some program like this, you know, over the long run could, you know, if it's researched and if the research shows this, could, you know, it could end up, you know, saving money. But I agree. I think that it'd be a really hard sell to say we're just going to pile this on top of every other you know, government program. I think that would be a difficult thing in this community or really any community in the United States.
All right. The phones have not stopped ringing and just trying to get through as many as we can. Keith in Brighton. Go ahead, Keith.
Well, I haven't. I'm in Victor now, but real quick, Mark John's comment. I can understand what he's trying to say, but in order to have somebody work substandard way and then the taxpayers chip in the difference, I think is ludicrous. Let the businesses pay for it if they're going to get the work from the person. But if we're going to give out cash vouchers to people because it's more efficient, which I agree, then why don't we do the same thing with homeless people? Mm-hmm. Let's give them, and I'm serious, let's give them a one-way bus ticket, and once they get to, say, Phoenix, they get $500. And guess what? If they're going to be homeless, let them be homeless someplace where it's warm.
Okay, Keith, thanks very much for the phone call. Anybody want to jump in there on the bus ticket? Erica, realistic? That's not going to happen. I mean, yeah. I like Keith. Keith's a smart guy, calls program a lot, but that's probably not palatable for a lot of people. What do you think?
Nope, I wouldn't think so. It's just interesting thinking about going back to kind of, you know, what do we do with this vis-a-vis the other government programs? I'm just kind of envisioning an experiment. And you know, Keith did bring up the homeless population and thinking about how you could kind of design a program where maybe you have actually three groups. It's randomized controlled, so people don't know which group they're going to end up in. One group gets cash. The other group continues trying to kind of make it with the the collection of social safety net programs that we have now, whether it's housing programs, food stamps, welfare payments, et cetera. And then the other group maybe gets nothing. And just comparing those outcomes again, you know, following for a certain amount of time and looking at how families and individuals do, and then making some decisions going forward about how we invest, as has been covered already.
All right, we're out of time here. Ron writes, this seems to be one of those areas where the disconnect between the economic scientific consensus and the politicians is so frustrating. Maybe. But 20 seconds, Erica, what's going to happen next year? CGR going to keep talking about this? So, I mean, will you meet with political leaders in the Anti-Poverty Initiative? What do you do?
I think it's certainly something that we are going to continue bringing up. We had one of our other writers blogging about it not too long ago. So I think it's something we'll continue to raise and suggest should be looked at.
I promise our listeners, if political leaders who are with the Anti-Poverty Initiative, if they take it seriously, we will come back and talk about this some more. But it'll be on them to see if they want to take it seriously. We're going to find out soon. Erica Rosenberg and Pete Nabosny from CGR, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Carolyn Lee Davis from the Children's Agenda, nice to see you as always. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
And thanks for all. I apologize, listeners, couldn't get through roughly half of the phone calls. A lot of interest in this subject, which just tells you, and not a lot of immediate rejection, which just tells you that I don't think it's going away just yet. We'll keep talking about this. Short break, and we're talking if there's such a thing as ethical hunting next.